We live in a culture that is just, well, absolutely obsessed with the makeover, like the grand reveal.
Oh, totally. New you?
Right. New relationship, new you. Mm. We treat our identities a lot like our smartphones, honestly. Just constantly staring at the screen, waiting for the next software update to, fix all our personal bugs and make us run a little faster.
Yeah, we keep downloading new external features like slapping on productivity hacks or picking up really expensive morning routines and just hoping the battery won't drain so fast this time around.
But it always does.
It always does.
Which is why today's deep dive is going to feel, well, a bit like a system shock. I am so glad you are here with us because we're looking at a stack of sources today that completely flip the script on what it actually means to change your life.
Yeah, it's a completely different paradigm.
We are pulling from a pair of really highly detailed lecture handouts, specifically lectures 17 and 34.
Mm-hmm.
And these detail the Being True to You transformational coaching model. And our mission for you today is to really unpack what holistic transformation truly looks like on a mechanical level. Like, we're going to explore how shedding your false identities and even leading directly into your own suffering can lead you to uncover your authentic core.
It's heavy stuff, but it's incredibly practical.
Okay, let's unpack this. Before we can even look at the steps of the coaching model, we have to talk about how these sources redefine the word change. Because, society's definition and this model's definition are just completely at odds.
Oh, they're completely opposed. The text actually argues that society is basically a machine designed to push us relentlessly toward what they call horizontal growth.
Horizontal growth, so secular pursuits, material success.
Exactly. Quick fixes, external validation. I mean, think about your average Tuesday, right? You are bombarded by targeted advertisements, social pressures.
Hidden algorithms.
Yes. Hidden algorithms that exploit very basic human vulnerabilities. They tempt you with cheap desires. And over time, chasing those desires causes a kind of collective amnesia.
We literally forget who we are.
Right. We become completely disconnected from our internal reality because we are spending all our energy just traveling outward.
We end up wandering miles away from home, looking for home.
That's a great way to put it.
And that is why transformation, according to this material anyway, is never about adding things to your life.
No, not at all.
You aren't trying to evolve into a brand new, optimized person. Transformation is strictly about returning to your true self.
Yeah.
Like, you are peeling back layers of conditioning, trauma, false beliefs.
And what the text refers to as karma.
Right. And just to clarify that term for anyone who doesn't, study Eastern philosophy, the sources are essentially talking about the accumulated baggage of cause and effect, the ingrained repetitive life patterns you've either inherited or just built up over decades.
You're dissolving every foreign part of your identity that isn't a reflection of your authentic essence.
Which is a profound shift in perspective. You are not building a new skyscraper. You are excavating an ancient ruin. It makes me think of restoring a beautiful piece of antique furniture. You know those videos where someone finds a dusty, painted-over dresser sitting on the curb?
I love those.
Right. You don't take that dresser home and just slap a fresh coat of cheap white paint on it to make it look new. That's horizontal growth.
Right. That's just covering up the problem.
Instead, you meticulously strip away decades of grime and cheap varnish and, terrible neon paint jobs from the 80s.
Yeah.
You use harsh chemicals to burn away the fake layers so you can reveal the original, flawless, solid wood underneath. The beauty was always there. It just had to be uncovered.
Well, the harsh chemical in your analogy is actually the perfect bridge to how this model views human suffering.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the text uses this fascinating historical metaphor regarding ancient alchemy. We hear the myths about medieval alchemists spending their entire lives in laboratories trying to literally turn heavy lead into solid gold.
Right, like Harry Potter stuff.
Exactly. But these sources suggest that the pursuit of physical gold was actually a mystical code. The real alchemy those philosophers were practicing was internal.
Wow.
It was the process of transforming their own inner pain, their sins, and their deepest flaws, which represents the heavy lead-in to spiritual virtue.
Okay, so then what was the fire?
The fire required to melt that lead down was the hard, agonizing lessons of life.
Suffering is the fire that burns off the cheap paint.
Precisely. In this framework, suffering isn't framed as a pointless tragedy, It acts as a necessary catalyst.
It has a purpose.
Right. When a person is pulled far enough into confusion, depression, or pain, that pain exposes their complete misalignment with their true nature. The friction causes what the text calls a motivational crisis.
A motivational crisis?
Yeah. It's a blaring alarm bell pointing the individual inward, basically demanding that they stop managing their symptoms with consumerism or doom scrolling and start addressing the root cause.
Wait, I have to push back on this a little bit. Is deep agonizing suffering absolutely required for a person to wake up?
Yeah.
Because if I look around, a lot of people's lives are just, well, they're fine.
Yeah, they're comfortable.
Right. They have a decent job. They go on vacation once a year. They haven't experienced a massive tragedy. Do they still have a true self to wake up to? Or are they just doomed to be stuck in horizontal growth forever because they haven't suffered enough?
No, it's a great question. And the text actually anticipates that exact concern. While intense trauma or a major life collapse brings a very undeniable call to action, it is not a strict prerequisite for transformation.
Okay, that's a relief.
Yeah. The sources point out that mild challenges do the exact same work, just at a lower volume.
What kind of mild challenges?
Think about everyday difficulties, like minor conflicts with a coworker, a subtle sense of boredom in your marriage, or even just a lingering dissatisfaction on a Sunday afternoon.
Sunday scaries.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Those mild challenges act as a subtle fire. They still bring your inner wounds and unhealthy attachments to the surface. They still provide the raw lead for you to melt down.
So the fire doesn't have to be a raging inferno. It can be a slow simmer.
Yes, exactly.
But whether it's a massive crisis or just a lingering sense of emptiness, that feeling is your cue to begin the work. But okay, once you receive that cue, how do you practically start stripping away your entire ego without completely unraveling? I mean, the prospect of burning away your defense mechanism sounds incredibly destabilizing.
Oh, it is highly destabilizing, which is why the coaching model provides a really rigid container for the process. Without a system to catch you, you would just fall apart.
Right.
The text lays out four structured stages of coaching, and the very first stage is preparation coaching.
Preparation.
Yeah. Before you do any deep spiritual excavation, you have to create an environment that can actually support the weight of that growth. This involves setting very practical, smart goals, specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-bound.
You know, I found it so striking reading these sources because on one page they're talking about mystical spiritual alchemy, and on the very next page they're handing you a corporate worksheet for smart goals.
It does feel a bit jarring.
It really does.
But what's fascinating here is how this model seamlessly bridges the highly practical with the profoundly spiritual. It's a brilliant safeguard.
How so?
Well, if you are going to dismantle your internal reality and challenge your deepest beliefs, you need a highly rigid, boring, practical tether to reality. Otherwise, you risk floating off into space. You prepare mentally and physically so your body can actually handle the stress of the psychological shifts to come.
Okay, so to use an analogy, it's like building a house. You can't put on the roof, which would be the deep transformational stuff, until you've poured the concrete foundation.
That's spot on. And once that foundation is set, the second stage is integration coaching. The sources describe this as natural maturation.
This is where the new behaviors are actually planted, right?
Yes. But this is also where you inevitably run headfirst into a brick wall of resistance. Resistance is basically the ego fighting for its life. The mind hates the unknown, even if the unknown is healthier. So when you try to integrate a new way of living, your brain deploys defense mechanisms. That resistance looks like sudden procrastination, overwhelming self-doubt, or an intense craving to revert to old, numbing habits.
Which brings up a question for me. During that second phase, integration, how does this model suggest we fight off the constant everyday societal pressure to just revert back to those easy, quick fixes? Like, think about the last time you tried to start a new healthy routine.
Oh, it's so hard.
You make it 3 days, and suddenly you find yourself ordering massive amounts of takeout and scrolling through social media for 4 hours.
Right, because the pressure for immediate gratification is always waiting to pull you back in. During this integration phase, the framework fights off that temptation by forcing you to analyze the resistance itself.
Analyze it instead of just fighting it.
Exactly. You don't just try to willpower your way through the doom scrolling. You stop and explore the limiting belief causing the craving. You identify the fear of failure, or sometimes the fear of actually succeeding.
By identifying the root of the sabotage, you disarm it.
Yes. But even with integration, people still stumble, you know. The friction of daily life wears down our defenses, which necessitates the third stage, Recovery coaching.
Recovery.
Yeah, and while the word recovery is heavily associated with addiction, in this model it applies to anyone dealing with severe trauma, major life transitions, or just deeply ingrained toxic patterns.
Right. I look at these first three stages a lot like physical therapy after a major injury.
Okay, let's hear it.
Well, preparation is your first day at the clinic. The therapist checks your range of motion and sets a baseline. Integration is the agonizing process of actually doing the stretches every single day, fighting the urge to quit because it hurts.
And recovery.
Recovery coaching is what happens when you accidentally tweak the muscle again. You have a flare-up. Recovery is about maintaining discipline when things go wrong.
Yes. It involves establishing fail-safes and contingency plans. You literally map out emergency protocols for high-risk situations so a single bad day doesn't erase 6 months of progress.
You're anticipating the triggers rather than just crossing your fingers and hoping they don't happen.
Exactly. And once you have the baseline, the stretches, and the brace for when things go wrong, you finally reach the peak stage. Transformational coaching.
The roof of the house.
The roof. This is where the profound spiritual shifts lock into place. It focuses on maintaining a daily, committed, practice-like meditation or deep breath work that continually connects you back to that true self.
So the client is finally making decisions from a place of pure alignment, dropping relationships or careers that no longer serve their highest good.
Right.
Okay, so we have the overarching timeline of these four stages, but what does the actual day-to-day journey feel like for you, the traveler? Because the sources are very clear that this is not a straight highway from stage one to stage four.
No, not at all. It is mapped out as a transformational spiral, and the shape is critical.
Why a spiral?
Well, a staircase implies that you conquer a step, leave it behind forever, and move up. But human psychology just doesn't work that way. A spiral means you are moving upward, but you continuously circle back over the exact same coordinates, just from a higher vantage point.
Right.
You might think you've conquered a deep-seated fear of rejection. 6 months later, a situation triggers it, and the fear returns.
And if you think growth is a straight line, that moment feels like total failure. You think, great, I'm back at square one.
Exactly. But in a spiral, you recognize the emotional landscape. You say, okay, I've been here before, but last time this fear paralyzed me for a month. This time it only derails me for an afternoon. That is the spiral in action.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Mm-hmm. The sources map this spiral out across 10 distinct levels, encompassing about 200 total mini-lessons.
It's massive.
We aren't going to read through all 200, obviously, but walking through the key transitions shows you exactly how the psychological mechanism of change operates. Level one is the reality check. It's the recognition that the way you are living is unsustainable.
Right. And that realization acts as a wedge leading to level two, the psychic shift.
The psychic shift.
Yeah, which sounds a bit mystical, but it's really a psychological earthquake. It is the exact moment your old mental model of the world fractures. The way you used to justify a toxic relationship or a dead-end job suddenly stops making sense. You can no longer unsee the dysfunction.
And once that glass shatters, you are left staring at the wreckage.
Yeah.
You have to clean it up, which naturally necessitates level three, integral healing. This is the restoration phase where you tend to the emotional wounds that the broken mental model left behind.
And healing leads directly into level four. Personal agency or differentiation. This is really the pivot point of the whole spiral.
How so?
You finally distinguish your authentic voice from the expectations imposed by your parents, your culture, or your boss. You reclaim your power, allowing you to move into level five, taking action, and level six, skills training.
You cultivate entirely new capacities to sustain this new version of yourself.
Right. Then level seven is self-regulation, mastering your internal states. So external chaos doesn't throw you off balance.
Okay, I want to pause the spiral right here, because level eight absolutely stopped me in my tracks.
Oh, I know what you're going to say.
Level eight is enjoying life. Celebration.
Yeah.
It is remarkably rare to see joy mapped out as a mandatory structural requirement in self-help literature. Usually these frameworks are all grind, grind, heal, confront your shadows, and then immediately go give back to your community.
Exactly.
But in this model, celebration comes right before level nine, which is social expression and contribution. Are these sources suggesting we can't truly serve others or leave a legacy until we've actually learned how to enjoy our own lives?
That is exactly the mechanism at play. If you skip celebration and rush straight into trying to save the world or serve your community, your service is likely born out of obligation. Or worse, a hidden desire for external validation.
Because you're still looking outward.
Yes. It comes from a place of depletion, which just breeds resentment. The text explains that actively celebrating your milestones and enjoying the freedom of your true self acts as a psychological reinforcer. By learning to experience joy first, your subsequent service work becomes an authentic overflow of your own well-being.
You cannot pour from an empty cup. When you serve from joy, it's a natural extension of who you are, rather than a forced duty.
Exactly. And then finally, level 10 is higher fruition, the actualization of the true self. But again, it's a spiral. Level 10 just feeds back into a broader awareness, ready for the next level of reality checks.
The work never truly ends.
No, it doesn't. And all of these levels are divided into four quadrants: inner work, outer work, healing work, and service work.
The quadrants.
Yeah, they act as a balanced diet for transformation.
Mm-hmm.
If you ignore one, the whole system destabilizes. We all know someone who does massive amounts of inner work. They meditate for 3 hours a day and read endless philosophy, but their outer work is a disaster.
Oh, yeah. They can't hold a job and they treat their friends poorly.
Exactly. Alternatively, you see people doing immense outer and service work, running charities and companies, but completely neglecting their healing work, resulting in chronic stress and emotional burnout.
So it demands a full spectrum approach.
Yeah.
And keeping all those plates spinning requires strict adherence to what the text calls truth-centered work, based on 10 moral principles.
Right.
Things like clarity, integrity, humility, and tenacity. This is not a breezy, whatever-feels-good mentality. It demands rigorous honesty.
The sources draw a harsh line. Transformation is intentional. You can actively work toward the best version of yourself, or entropy will slowly drag you toward the worst. There is no neutral gear.
So with this massive blueprint laid out, the four stages, the 10-level spiral, the quadrants, the principles, the final question we have to answer is about execution. We have the map, but who is actually driving the car on this expedition?
The sources are uncompromising here. Transformation is entirely an inside job. The client must take absolute accountability to deprogram their own central operating system. No one else can do it for them.
Not even the coach.
Not even the coach. The coach's role is purely to balance structure and flow. They hold the holistic map of the client's life, but let the client naturally dictate the pace and direction. If we connect this to the bigger picture,
yeah,
this model is radically empowering because it rejects the modern instinct to outsource our healing. We are so conditioned to walk into a professional's office, point to our pain, and say, "Fix me." This framework hands ultimate authority and agency back to the individual.
So the coach is essentially like a car's GPS system.
Mm.
The GPS can show you the holistic map, point out traffic delays, and suggest a route, but it physically cannot press the gas pedal for you.
Right, exactly.
But I have to push back here. If it is entirely an inside job and the client is doing all the heavy lifting,
mm-hmm,
why do they need to commit to a coach for a whole year? Because the sources say this usually requires 6 to 12 months of weekly sessions, if not longer.
Yes, they do.
Couldn't someone just read the 10 principles and do it themselves?
It's a completely fair question. The answer lies in the deeply deceptive nature of our own false selves. While the client does the work, the coach provides the vital fail-safes.
Right, the emergency protocols we talked about.
Exactly, and real-time accountability. They help the client recognize when they are completely blinded by their own false layers, things that are incredibly difficult to see objectively on your own.
Mm.
When you are inside the jar, you cannot read the label.
Wow, yeah.
Without an outside perspective, it is incredibly easy to take a detour disguised as progress or to normalize self-sabotaging behaviors because they feel familiar.
You trick yourself into thinking you're doing inner work when you're actually just hiding from outer work.
Precisely. A coach spots that evasion immediately. The 6 to 12 month time frame is stated because you are systematically dismantling decades of complex psychological conditioning. You cannot rush the spiral.
You need someone outside the system to help you see the system.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean? Let's bring everything we've covered today into focus. We started by redefining the concept of change itself, exploring the alchemy of turning suffering into virtue.
Mm-hmm.
We walked through the four structural stages of coaching: preparation, integration, recovery, and transformation. We mapped out the 10-level transformational spiral and the profound truth that celebrating our joy is a prerequisite to authentically serving others.
Right.
And we finally landed on the ultimate reality of healing. The fact that we hold the ultimate responsibility in our own healing.
It is a massive, comprehensive roadmap, but at its core, it is a journey of unlearning rather than learning.
And for you listening right now, here is why internalizing this framework matters. By shifting your focus from horizontal societal achievement that look impressive on a resume to vertical growth uncovering your true self, you ensure that your time, focus, and energy are spent on a life that is authentically yours.
You finally step off the treadmill.
Yes. But as you think about stepping off that treadmill and shedding those layers of conditioning, we want to leave you with a final puzzle to mull over.
Yeah, this raises a really interesting question. We've talked extensively today about finding our pure, original, unconditioned state, the true self. But consider this. How might the very language, the frameworks, and the self-help concepts we use to find ourselves secretly just be another layer of modern conditioning?
Oh, wow.
Right. Like, are the psychological tools we are using to break free eventually going to become the next layer of varnish we need to strip away?
Are we just downloading a new operating system in order to delete the old operating system?
Exactly.
That is a wild thought. That is absolutely something to explore on your own. Remember, we aren't looking for a software update. We are looking for the original hardware, the flawless wood underneath the paint. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive today. Keep questioning the map, keep peeling back those layers, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.
Take care, everyone.